All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fucking ears, what the fuck sticks, what the fuck rakers? All right, that's enough of that. How are you? I'm Mark Maron. This is WTF. How are you? How are you? Who are you talking to? Today on the show, Gabriel Iglesias, whose new concert film, The Fluffy Movie, comes out this Friday, July 11th. Gabriel Iglesias, who I've heard of and known of for years and have never met. But for years, he was always the guy that was just at the club. He was just, oh yeah, Gabriel was just here. We sold out the month. Oh yeah, Gabriel Iglesias was here. We had to turn people away. Yeah, I don't know what's wrong this week. It must be because it's nice out. Them's were the days, folks. Them's were the days. Oh, you know who else is coming up that I wanted to mention? Because sometimes I can't sync everything up with everything else. But Ian Edwards, who's hilarious, who you know, I talked to recently, we're going to put that WTF up, and I want to give a little love to his new comedy record, 100% Half-Assed. It's available to download at TeamCocoRecords.com. He's actually the first artist on Conan O'Brien's Team Coco record label, and that's great. Here's the deal. Here's what's going on. A lot of you are asking me when I'm going to come to your town. Look, I need to plan a tour. I want to plan a tour. I've been talking about planning a tour, but we are waiting. We are waiting to see if the show gets picked up, which will make it a little different. If my show, Maron, gets picked up again for another season, I have to start working pretty quickly. So a thorough and multi-city tour will be a little difficult, but I should know something within the next week or so. I want to come perform for you. I'm excited to perform. I like performing. The Oddball Festival dates are up. I've got dates coming up in several different cities with that Oddball Fest. Most of the cities I'm going to, I've never been to. I've got dates coming up. Oh, shit. Oh, yeah. I'm going to be in Denver, man. I am going to be in Denver on the 18th and 19th at the Comedy Works. That's July. That's like a week. That's like 2 weeks away, kind of. A little less than 2 weeks away, Denver, at the Comedy Works. And I've got other dates coming up. You can go to WTFpod.com and look at the calendar and get those. But that's what I'm waiting for. So I'm either going to tour in the fall or I'm going to tour thoroughly in the spring with some scattered dates, even if they do pick the show up in the fall. So I will keep you abreast of that. So New York, how was New York, Mark? It was great. I did another scene on another episode of the popular show Girls. Few lines. But you know, it had teeth. I was a real character. I manufactured a comb over effect with my hair. I saw Lena Dunham and we had a nice chat and it was fun to be on a set and working with, Alex Karpowski, a very good guy. And it was exciting. It's exciting to act. It's a long day. It wasn't that long. There are longer ones, but you know, you wait around, you do it takes and you know, you nail it. It's nice to nail it. Get a few options in the can, get some coverage. But it's rare that I go back to New York and I get that longing, the longing to stay in New York. You know, I spent a lot of time there, and it's odd that I get it in the middle of summer, which I think is most people's. Well, winter's pretty bad too, but summer's heavy, man. Humidity is upon you. You're like in a pressure cooker. You're just sort of damp and exhausted. Everybody walking through the city looks like they're on the way back from doing something shameful. It just looks like one parade of shame. Just people have given up. They can't keep their hair up. They can't keep their makeup straight. They're not going to wear long pants. Everybody's slightly hunched, slightly dragging, and they can't hide. That's what humidity does. It melts away pretense, and you can see the true being of anybody because they're like, what? I'm hot. Leave me the fuck alone. This is who I am today. Yeah, I see you. I see you. So what did I do? I did the girls' shoot, and then I hung out. I did a little comedy. I went to the Eastville Comedy Club and did a set there in the basement there. At Marco's Club, and then I went over to the Cellar, which I don't always do, because there's some parts of your it's almost how I used to feel about the Comedy Store. There's some parts about, you know, going back to where you came from. If some of that time was not great, it's like going to meet the abuser. I forget that I'm not that guy anymore, and I'm an older guy, and I love going to the Cellar to see the boys and the girls who are doing the stand up. Pow! Look out! I shit my pants. Just coffee.coop, available at WTFpod.com. Anyways, So yeah, I wandered over to the cellar. I didn't have a spot. I didn't know if I'd get one, but it was great, man. It's a great place. I mean, I know you see it on Louis, but there's something about, you know, being a comic and just, you know, having enough gravitas to sit back there at the table and hang out with your peers and eat some food. And Noam, whose father used to run the place and own it, man, he has passed, but Noam's doing it, and he's a little less hands on. It's a little more pleasant, though. You know, I miss the old man because I miss arguing. But who was there that night? Jim Norton. Good to see Jim looking healthy. Who else? Keith Robinson, of course. Lenny Marcus. Greg Rogel was there. I didn't see Louie. I went with my producer, Brendan McDonald. We spent the evening running around, doing the comedy, eating the food. And Judd Apatow is in New York shooting his new film with Amy Schumer. So he's doing stand-up. I don't know how long it's been since he's really done stand-up, but apparently he's just been hanging out doing the stand-up. So he was hanging around. And it's just, it's pretty great when Copelitz, I don't know. It's just, it's a rare thing. Ted Alexandro, it's just, I don't even know how to explain it, because this is, you know, this is the world I live in. This is our job. But to be able to hang around, yeah, after not seeing somebody and people for months and months or even years, you just sit at that back table and everybody gets caught up. And Judd Apatow sitting there, arguably one of the most powerful men in show business. But, you know, at the table, he's just a guy doing comedy and we're all having some laughs, busting balls. He's a good guy. I watched him. He watched me. Apparently, I made him nervous, which I can be between me and you and him if he's listening. That was flattering. I was flattered that he got off stage after I watched him and he told me that I made him a little nervous. I was like, oh, okay. Because like back in the day when I was doing sets, why do I get that back in the day thing? That's getting tired. But I used to kick the comics out of the room. Like when I would go on at the cellar when I was you know, just starting out working there, I was already about 8 or 9 years in probably. If Attell or Louis or Mark Cohen or anyone was in the room when I went on, the first thing I'd say on stage is like, get out. This isn't for you. I have to figure out how to talk to these people. I can't accommodate whatever's going to make you laugh. And I'd literally throw Dave Attell out if he was in the room when I went on stage. But all in all, good time. And the reason I like the humidity between you and I, because I've been a little dry, a little crazy, a little at edge, is that, you know, you walk around for a half an hour in that type of heat with that type of humidity, and it's as close to being high as I'm going to be. You're just dazed and moving slow. And I find it relaxing. And then there was a rainstorm. To see the clouds gather over New York City and just know it's coming. There is actually a calm before the storm. There was some sort of hurricane going on in North Carolina or down on the coast. And some of it was coming up to New York and we knew it was coming. And me and Brendan are walking through the street and start to drizzle. But you could see that, you could feel the cool, weird breeze and the clouds collecting in the sky. And it was drizzling. We're trying to get over the cellar from Little Italy. So we're just trying to make it before whatever the fuck is going to happen is going to happen. And we weren't there yet, man. And there was like drizzling and then there was nothing. There was just silence and a weird breeze and a grayness, that just foreboding Ghostbuster sky. I looked at Brendan, I'm like, it's going to happen any second, because there was nothing happening. There was almost a vacuum of silence. And then this kapow of thunder and then a boom of lightning. And then the clouds just dumped, just fucking unloaded. And it was glorious. And there was some kids. You know, we're standing there under the awning of a supermarket trying to figure out how we're going to get the three blocks without being, you know, wet for the evening. And then there were these two little kids that didn't give a shit. And they were just dancing in the rain, dancing around, getting soaked, laughing. And I thought to myself, God, why aren't we doing that? Why are we not doing that? That's a good question. But right now, you're going to experience a first conversation with me and a very big comedian, very popular comedian. I don't know if you know Gabriel Iglesias, but he comes out of a scene that I know nothing about, really. And I was excited to talk to him. And his movie is out Friday. That's the Fluffy movie. comes out this Friday the 11th, and I'll explain the Fluffy thing. You know what? He'll explain it because he had to explain it to me. The what would you call it? Is it the etymology of Fluffy? When has that ever been said? All right, let's talk to Gabriel Iglesias. Gabriel Iglesias, I don't know if we've ever met, really.
I can't say that we have.
It's so fucked up. I mean, I've been doing comedy for 25 years, and everywhere I go, you know, they're like, oh, yeah, Gabriel Iglesias just sold out the entire city. Gabriel Iglesias was right here. We had to turn people away. I don't know why there's 12 people here. Iglesias was just here. We had to add a week. That's who you are.
I've been very fortunate. Very, very fortunate. Things are going good, man. No complaints.
But, I mean, how long have you been doing it?
This is my 17th year.
So it's been a long fucking time.
Yeah. I've been on the road for since day one. You know, I'm on the road 40 plus weeks out of the year.
So you started when you were a kid?
20 years old.
Well, where'd you grow up?
Long Beach.
You grew up in Long Beach?
Yeah.
Your mom and dad are down there?
No, unfortunately, my mom is no longer with us.
I'm sorry.
I barely see my dad. But Long Beach is where I grew up. I started off in San Diego, you know, spent most of my life in Long Beach, and that's still where
how many kids in the family?
I'm the last of six.
So it's big.
It's decent size. For a Mexican family, actually six is right around the average.
Big Catholic family.
In my mom's case, yes and then no, because I wasn't raised Catholic. I was raised just, you know, be good to people.
Right, right.
There was no real religion in
the
house.
Oh, you didn't have that?
For my brother and sisters, hardcore Catholic to the point where they were sent to like a Catholic boarding school in Mexico. And then my mom with me, I was like, there's 15 years between my sister and myself. So I was the one that got regular public school and I got
so,
to keep.
So they were like, well, maybe things relaxed. They got the hang of it, or why was your brother and sister, your mother was more Catholic when she was younger?
I still couldn't, you know, to this day, I don't know exactly what happened there. I mean, there was a whole different life before I came about.
Really?
Oh, yeah. I mean, my brother and four sisters came from one dad, and I came from the bonus dad from my mom's, you know, fun weekend.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I heard you talk about that on stage.
Yeah,
didn't you?
Yeah.
Oh, that's interesting.
So, I mean, hey, it worked out.
So what about the other dad? Is he around still?
No, he died a long time ago.
Oh, really?
A long time ago.
I can't even imagine boarding school in Mexico. I mean, what do you got to do?
Find a way to get out of there. That's what you got to do, man.
But so you grew up in this weird family in the sense that there was that much time between you and your brothers. Are you close with them?
No, not anymore. Comedy does things. It either brings everybody together or you become that guy that, you changed. You're not the same.
They say that to you.
Yeah. Oh, you're Hollywood now. How am I? I'm on the road freaking earning a living.
You're making a living, right.
You know, and so I'm Hollywood until they need a loan. And then I'm Banco the Fluffy.
Oh, sorry.
So then it changes.
Where did this Fluffy thing come from?
Oh, it's a nickname that started, 15, 16 years ago. And at the end of my show, nobody remembered Gabriel Iglesias, but they remembered, oh, hey, Fluffy. Uh-huh. And I'm like, really? And at first it bothered the hell out of me because it was a really cute joke in the beginning. And then it grew. And then I just learned to embrace it and then just brand it.
Uh-huh.
And I started branding it that far back to where now if you Google Fluffy, I'm the number one search.
So you were that aware of it early on, that Fluffy was the thing?
It stuck. And you got to be one of those guys that you got to realize when you catch lightning in a bottle and this is something that people automatically gravitate to. I got to expose that. I got to work on that. I got to keep working on it. That, the Hawaiian shirt thing, always wearing shorts, keeping something that is consistent.
Right.
There's guys that always change their look, always change their appearance. They add a special.
Yeah, I was one of those guys. Yeah. I didn't go down to one name, though. You know, like, remember in the 80s, there was like a just Jose, you know, or whatever.
It's just
like,
him.
Yeah, you know, but like, there was a couple of one-namers, like Mitch Hedberg briefly was Mitch.
Was just Mitch, because there was no other Mitches out there.
Yeah, right. But I mean, I was never that conscious of looking for hooks. And then subsequently, I'm not releasing a movie. But I don't think it's just because I didn't have a hook. So you grow up, so most of the other kids were out of the house?
Yeah, well, everybody was gone by the time I showed up. I mean, you know, you got to figure I was probably 2 years old when my sister finally decided to move out of the house. And so it was basically like growing up as an only child. My brother and sisters were more like cousins that would just, you know, show up every now and then because they were off doing their own thing.
So it was just your mom?
It was just my mom and me.
Where'd they all end up, your brothers and sisters?
Most of them are in California. My second oldest sister got in the Air Force.
Oh, yeah?
So she took off. She's in Germany.
Wow. And the other, they just have regular jobs.
And the other ones, I don't know exactly. I think my brother's a truck driver. One of my sisters got into real estate, which you saw what happened.
Yeah.
The other one works for an optometrist. So
it's just regular jobs.
Yeah, yeah. And
you're the rock star.
Well, I'm the one that took chances.
Yeah. So when your mother was always supportive of the thing?
My mom was supportive of whatever it was that would make you happy. She was very realistic in that. You know, most parents, they push their kids to get A's and get A's and get B's and go to college and do, I mean, really putting a lot of like pressure on a kid to, you know, you got to get to this level. Whereas my mom was like, look, if you want to make me happy, just graduate high school and whatever you want to do with your life after that, I'll support it, whatever it is. And
really?
I'm just like, yeah. You know, and I mean, I graduated high school with like C's and D's.
Yeah. But, so your options were limited.
I guess so. But she knew that I always wanted to become a comic, and so she was very.
When did
much
you know that?
10 years old.
Seriously,
10 years old.
Because of who?
I saw Eddie Murphy Raw in 1987, and 2 weeks later, I did a school talent show, and I was just doing impressions of Eddie Murphy without the cussing, obviously, and it went over very well. And right then and there, I was like, you know what? I want to be a comic. And I was always talking about this. And
what do you think the feel? Wait, do you think when you first saw it? Because I know my experience when I first saw comics was like they got it figured out. They got a handle on this. They have control. They can make people laugh. They know how to look at the world. They made me feel better. That's got to be the greatest job in the world.
Yeah, and when I saw that, I'm like, wow, everybody loves them. The energy, everyone's happy. You know, I wanted to be him so bad. And I'm like, oh, this is what I want.
And you weren't a fucked up kid?
You know, I grew up, I mean, broken homes. I mean, I didn't grow up with my dad. I grew up with my mom. We didn't live in the greatest neighborhood. But I mean, I didn't know I was poor. My mom was very conscious of the fact that she didn't want me to think that we were poor. She would just tell me stuff like, you were bad and that's why you didn't get what you wanted, because you were bad, not because we couldn't afford it.
Right, right.
And then later
so
on in
so you were
life,
bad a lot.
Yeah, so she made me feel guilty a lot, but it kept me from knowing that we were financially
Is it pretty broad scale of bad? You know, like, I mean, like, you know, you were bad,
real minor things. Oh, you didn't clean your room. Exactly. You were bad. That's it. You're not getting anything. Yeah. I didn't get into too much trouble as a kid. I mean, there were rough neighborhoods, and from time to time, I was caught doing, you know, maybe some graffiti or...
You were a tagger?
Dumping over a... Not even a tagger, because I didn't even have a name. It was just like... You
Fluffy.
Know, like, at the time, I didn't have Fluffy.
that's you know, a just, hell of a tag.
You know, just drawing, you know, stupid little cartoons on a wall or something. It wasn't even like a professional, like with a can of Krylon or anything.
Yeah.
It was just, you know, it was minor stuff. And,
But you didn't hang out with bad crowd?
I tried to, but my mom always kept me inside.
Oh, yeah?
That was her thing. She'd keep me inside. No matter what, she's like, no, you can't go play with Sniper and Spider. Get your ass in the house.
Just because their names were Sniper and Spider?
Yeah. Oh, man. It was one of those neighborhoods where everybody had a nickname.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
What was going on down there?
Well, it was on the border of East Side and West Side of Long Beach. And so all the gangs would always have their fights, basically, in my neighborhood.
Were there a big gang presence there?
You know, as a kid, for me, I'd always hear the gunshots.
Oh, really?
I never saw anyone get shot.
See, I have no sense of that area.
Mm.
Yeah, I mean, I've been in neighborhoods where that's going on. You're like, what was that? Was that a celebration or someone?
Yeah, right. Cinco de Mayo.
Wait, it's not Cinco de Mayo. Someone must be hurt.
it was a rough neighborhood. The neighbor's kid got killed. I didn't see that, but you know, I remember the funeral.
Gunned down.
No, he jumped on the hood of a car and somebody shook him off and he wound up getting thrown.
He jumped on the hood of a car
He jumped on the hood of a car and then the guy just, you know, he drove and drove with him on the hood and then slammed on the brakes.
Because that was the fight? He was fighting a car?
Well, whoever it was in the car. I guess it really pissed. Anytime you're mad enough to jump on the hood of a car, something went down.
But your mother was pretty...
He wasn't like fighting Autobots or anything. You know?
No, I know. How do you end up on the hood of a car moving? That's tricky. So, so your mother was always protective of you?
Extremely protective of me. Always kept me inside. I mean, I was a little bit sheltered in the beginning. She wouldn't let me see what was out there. And, you know, I love her more for that because she did keep me away from a lot of the bad elements.
Yeah, it's hard to do that.
And she definitely encouraged dreaming and just being happy. That was her thing. Just, you know, whatever makes you happy, mijo, you go and you want to do.
Well, how did she explain your dad?
You know, I didn't really have a lot of questions about my dad.
Why is that?
I guess... Because my mom really filled the shoes.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't like there was like, oh man, there's nobody here to help me with this or that. My mom had to play double roles.
Right.
And it was to the point where I remember doing this a lot. On Father's Day, I would actually give my mom a Father's Day card. And I'd say, hey, thank you for being my mom and my dad because, you know, you were there. And
yeah.
I didn't feel like I lacked anything.
Right. But you never wondered or had a longing or?
Oh, I knew the story about my dad, him being a mariachi in Mexico. And of course, you know, the mariachi lifestyle. He's out there traveling the world, entertaining.
Where'd your mom meet the mariachi? I know you might have covered this, but I think it's sort of interesting because mariachi music, it's like you just think, because as a comic, I mean, we both fucking know. You've been living this life a long time. You know what the road is. But, you know, one of the things that you don't necessarily think is like mariachis are just these out of control fucking, you know, warriors. You know, just these road pigs that are out. There, like,
you can't see them turn up hotel rooms and
right,
you know,
but they
flipping over benches.
I'm sure they do.
Hey, man, it's entertainment. That's why I have a strong connection to professional wrestling. Because it's like, yeah, it's entertaining, but I run into these guys all the time at the hotels and the airports.
Yeah.
And it's the same lifestyle.
It's the exact same lifestyle. So where did she meet him? In Mexico?
She met him in Tijuana at some nightclub one night.
Was she living down there?
No, she was living in San Diego.
Oh, and she drove.
Yeah, she got into a big fight with her husband. And it was one of those, you'll never do better than me. And yeah. Like, really? And then freaking next thing you know, she's across the border with her friends at some nightclub. And that's where she met my dad. My dad was performing that night. And, you know, they hooked up. And 9 months later, I showed up.
Out of spite.
You know what? Whatever it takes. That's why I don't judge women that do. Hey, if you're not happy in your relationship and you take off.
I'll show him.
The ultimate, I'll show him.
Yeah. So what happened? How long did that marriage last?
They hooked up. They didn't get married.
With the other husband.
Oh, the marriage fizzled a little bit after that.
After you were born?
Yeah, definitely. So I didn't know this, that there was a lot of, friction with my brother and sisters towards me. I didn't realize that there was that
you represented a betrayal.
Yeah. So, I mean, later on in life, I started catching it more and more. But, you know, as a kid, you don't look for signs like that. You're just there and you're doing your thing. But there was.
Yeah.
There was. They wound up getting a divorce. And then my mom and dad hooked up for a couple years. And then.
They did?
Yeah. They were living together. And my dad wanted to actually take us to Mexico and have a life over there. And my mom was like, no, we're going to stay here. And he's like, well, I got to go back home. And she's like, well, you got to do what you got to do. So it wasn't like he just left and that was it. There was more to it. Yeah, he did try. And so my mom did tell me that. So there was never this, oh, I hate my dad or how dare he. It was just, you know, that was his life over there.
Yeah, and there's not many people that are going to jump the States to go back to Mexico.
You know, he had a pretty good gig. So, I mean.
But was he, like, is he a citizen here, though?
He's a citizen of Mexico.
Right, so the choice between San Diego and going to have a life in Mexico, I imagine, given you know what you wanted opportunities for you, was probably a big easy choice. Well, he's gonna
and also too, to his credit, I mean, he was very successful in what he did, and he came from a very big family. I mean, there was over 13 kids in that family, and most of them were musicians, and there was a few politicians and a couple of priests.
Oh yeah,
in that family. So everybody
they got it
was,
all covered.
Yeah, they were covered. So it wasn't like he needed to come here to the promised land to make it, you know, happen and stuff like that. He had a good gig.
And did you meet him?
As a kid, I remember just little images of, you know, him trying to teach me how to play a guitar or how to do the sign of the cross when you're, you know, in church and stuff. But no, that was about it. And then 30 some odd years later, he shows up at the Comedy and Magic Club in Hermosa Beach. And the manager, Richard, comes up to me and he goes, hey, are we picking up your dad's tab in the back? I go, what are you talking about? He goes, yeah, your dad's in the back of the room. I go, I haven't seen my dad in over 30 years. I go, it's just some guy trying to get free food and free drinks. And he goes, oh, okay, we'll cut him off. And then after the show was over, I go outside and I'm taking pictures and signing DVDs with the fans. And my dad gets in line with the fans. And then my manager goes to the back of the line. She comes to me. She goes, listen, Gabe, I think your dad's in the back of the line. And I'm like, shut up. You too?
How long ago was this?
This was a couple years ago. And it turned out to be him. And I freaked out. And we wound up having dinner the next day there at the comedy club. And
how'd you freak out?
I did freak out. I freaked out. I mean, I was
anger, sadness,
everything,
weirdness?
Everything. Because it's like, you know, I haven't seen this guy in 30 some odd years.
Did you cry a little bit?
I got emotional.
Yeah.
I got emotional. So, I mean, it was a combination of excited, upset, just real, just charged up. I was rushed. I, It's like I wanted to hit him and hug him. So it was like, it was really weird, you know?
Yeah.
To have everything hitting you at the same. I mean, if I would have been stoned, forget it, man. Who knows what would have happened? But
wow. So he's there, and like, were people around, or did you go inside? Or?
It was just it was him, his friend, and my girlfriend, and myself. And I didn't want to meet him alone, so I had my girl there with me. And plus, you know, he only speaks Spanish, and my Spanish is pretty decent, but yeah. You know, to get into the real technical, real deep, where the hell were you type words, I needed a little backup. So my girl was there. She watches a lot of Telemundo.
And she translated your emotional.
Anytime I had a stumble or something, you know, what was going through your mind during that time that made you want to leave? And so words like that for me, I was kind of like trying to think, okay, I've never asked anyone something like that in Spanish. So I'm more like, hey, you know, ¿dónde está el baño? Más carne asada, can I get un limón, una soda? Yeah. I didn't know how to get real technical with the words.
So this happened at dinner or right when the night he came?
Well, the night he came, I didn't see him or meet him that night just because it
did
he,
you
he
look
caught me off
like,
guard.
Holy fuck.
I saw him from a distance.
Yeah.
And you know, it's like, how do I meet my fans and just try to take the compliment?
Keep it together.
Hey, good show. Can you sign my DVD? Yeah, make it out like, to Charles.
That's my dad.
You know, and then, you know,
see that?
Because I freaked out and somebody saw me and they go, are you okay? And I said, look. And I started repeating it over and over. I said, my dad's here. My dad, I was freaking out. I was like, my dad's here. My dad's here. And they're like, well, that's good. Your dad's here to support you. And I'm like, no, I haven't seen him in 30 years. And they're like, awkward.
That is crazy, man. So you planned dinner.
We planned dinner for the next day, and he answered a lot of questions. And he told me I had two sisters in Mexico, and, you know, just can we see each other again? And he told me he doesn't want any money. He's doing very well. He just wants to have a relationship that he didn't have.
Wow.
And it was kind of, we saw each other a few times after that.
You
and
did?
Then, yeah, we had dinner, and just trying to talk, and he really wanted me to go to Mexico still. You got to go meet your sisters. I'm like, I don't talk to the ones I got now. I don't got time for new ones. And
isn't some part of you think that might be interesting?
Yes,
have you spent time in Mexico?
No, but you know what, man? There's too much stuff going on in Mexico.
Yeah, I know, it's scary. You don't want to get kidnapped?
That's the last thing I want is to get kidnapped. Right. Like, for me, I'd rather go to Iraq.
Right, because you're a public figure. I mean, you would be a target.
Mm-hmm.
Most likely. What part of Mexico do you live in?
Aguacaliente, Mexico, which I think is over towards more like towards the bottom of Texas.
But it must be profound to just like, did you get some closure? Did it give you some peace?
I did. And I appreciated the fact that, you know, he said that him and my mom were actually in love, which was nice. He goes, you got to know. He goes, you were actually made out of love. It wasn't like we just hooked up and that was it. He goes, you know, I loved your mom and she loved me. And I was just like, oh my God, this is where I started getting all, you know, choked up.
Yeah.
And I think that's probably what really pissed off my brother and sisters is that, you know.
Wait, later?
They didn't get conceived under the same circumstances. Oh, right.
you're right.
No, theirs wasn't love. I think theirs was more like Budweiser or something like that.
Oh, that guy was a monster, huh? The other husband? Yeah, well, I mean, I can't even imagine what that'd be like because, you know, I've had fights with my father. If I don't talk to him for 6 months and then we get back together, it's sort of like, ugh. But yeah, but I mean, but he missed your whole childhood.
Yeah, and so.
But he must be proud.
He is, and, you know, I know he wishes he could have been there to see more, but then he tells me, he says, look, everything happens for a reason. Who knows what's to say that I wouldn't have done something that would have led you in a different direction and you wouldn't be here now.
You believe that?
I believe in the whole butterfly effect, definitely.
Sure,
you know,
sure.
Something happens and it triggers it.
But you, was there part of you like, well, that's a good rationalization, you know?
I mean, I'm in an amazing place now, and you know, if things would have been different, then this would have been different. So
sure.
I can't get too upset.
So
he probably wanted me to be a singer. Or a politician or a priest.
Yeah, it wasn't going to happen.
Yeah. No. I'll do mariachi music when I'm doing shots of tequila and I'm at some karaoke bar in friggin' Fargo or something.
Right. Did you ever see him play? You never saw him play.
I never got to see him play, but I have heard his music. I've got a lot of his old albums.
Oh, he put out a lot of records?
He put out, a bunch of, you know, it's not like they went global or anything.
Right.
But, you know, when you're holding a record and it's got his name on it, that's pretty cool.
And is he good?
He's pretty good.
Yeah?
He's pretty good. He's got a great voice.
Yeah? That's fucking amazing, man. It's amazing to know that you come
from
creative people,
mm-hmm.
from show business people. I mean, you know, it's weird. You know, a lot of that stuff you don't think it's genetic, but you know, you're a hell of a showman, and you know, you come from a guy who was an entertainer.
He was an entertainer, and I have an uncle who was an actual comedian in Mexico, who his name was Pompín Iglesias. He did TV. film, stand up. I mean, you name it. He did everything there is to do in Mexico. He had, a bunch of sponsorships. So he was always doing commercials for, whatever products or cars or whatever. And he was very funny.
Did you ever look up his stuff?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. You can Google them.
It's really interesting that, like, you know, because a lot of, like, white people, you know, going to make fun of Telemundo or whatever, or the sort of broad comedy, like Contenfloss, you know, from years ago.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So, like, do you feel connected in any way to that tradition of delivery? You know, like,
old school delivery of the way they did it in Mexico, it's more long story with a big punchline at the end versus consistent joke. Like, if I'm talking for 3 minutes and I don't get a laugh, you know what? I might need to shorten that talking and throw a couple punches in there.
That's
a long time.
But you do long form.
I do long form, definitely, but there's laughs every 30 seconds. Yeah.
So like, the classic way would be tell a really long story and then go, whoa! Yeah.
Pepito, buen hombre.
It's funny though. It is funny.
It is silly. You hear a lot of that, like in morning radio shows that they do here in LA.
Yeah.
Yeah, with just this long story, and then at the end, and then you hear the canned laugh track.
But you didn't really grow up with Spanish in the house, though.
From my mom, I did until I was about 6 years old, and then she wanted to make it. You know, she didn't want to make it hard for me in school, so she said, "Listen, from now on, I'm going to speak to you in English because I want to make sure that you don't have any problems in school."
Right.
Because originally they stuck me in an ESL program. They put me in an English as a second language program when I was about 5-6 years old because just, my last name was Iglesias and they'd hear my mom speaking Spanish and they just assumed, oh, okay, he needs to learn English because he only speaks Spanish. And I'm like, I spoke English. I was cool, but just growing up, my mom wanted me to make sure that I didn't have any issues.
Right. And when did you start actively, pursuing the comedy thing?
April 10th, 1997, I got pushed up on stage in Long Beach by a friend of mine. They needed an MC. The MC didn't show up, and I had always talked about wanting to be a comic.
Yeah.
And he goes, dude, man, they need an MC. Just go up there, crack a couple jokes. This would be a good chance for you to get up there. And I was scared.
Yeah.
And he pushed me up there, and I made fun of him. The crowd saw him push me up there, and I cracked maybe 2 or 3 jokes, and I got laughs, and that was it. I got the bug right there.
Uh-huh.
And then somebody saw me, and they actually had a comedy room there at that same place on Wednesday nights. And he goes, hey, man, you do comedy? And I'm like, yeah. Real kind of like, yeah. I wasn't trying to tell him that was my first time. He goes, hey, man, you come back on Wednesday, man. I'll give you $20, do 10 minutes. And I'm like, are you serious? First paid gig already. And I didn't have 10 minutes, man. I had what I had at that moment.
Nothing. Yeah. So what'd you do?
I winged it. I winged it for 10 minutes. And
what, crowd work?
A lot of crowd work. But, I was being silly, making some voices and stuff, and it worked.
How old were you?
You got to figure 90. I was 20.
And what were you working after you graduated high school? What were you doing?
Yeah, man. After high school, I had a couple jobs. I worked over at Robinson's May. It later became Macy's.
Yeah.
I used to work doing telemarketing and stuff like that. I'd answer phone calls, customer service, whatever they needed and stuff like
were
that.
Were you in hell?
It was a good gig. I mean, I was in an office. I had a tie on. I'd show up to work and everybody was friendly. I'm talking to people. All I'm doing all day is talking. So, I mean, for me, I enjoyed it. It was cool.
Yeah.
I'm interacting with people. So
right.
It was nice. From there, I went on to, I worked for a company called LA Cellular. Later on, they became AT&T. You remember the first cellular phone companies in town? It was AirTouch at LA Cellular. And I was selling cell phones inside of a Walmart in a kiosk.
Oh my God.
So I did that for a couple of years and it was actually a pretty good gig. You figure I was 20 years old. I was making probably $4,500 a month. I didn't have any responsibilities. Combination of commissions and just regular salary.
And it was a new thing, so everybody wanted one.
Yeah, and I had a free phone that was unlimited, so I didn't have to worry about that bill. My rent was $350. I had a roommate. We were stealing cable. I had a really cool black box that just, we didn't have to worry about that.
And this was in San Diego?
No, this was in Long Beach,
Signal
Hill area. So, I mean, life was good.
Yeah.
So to give up that $4,500 a month, and because I was burning the candle at both ends. Once I started doing stand-up, I was finding every single little room I could hit.
What were those rooms then?
Oh, man, at the time, it was this place in Montebello called Wild Coyote. It had another name called Gotham and Prime Cut. I mean, every year, the guy would change the name.
Well, what kind of rooms were those? I never heard of those.
Ghetto
rooms.
Hood rooms, man. I mean, these were like, they were biker bars.
Uh-huh. But like, what kind of hood? They were Latino rooms?
Yeah.
Or they,
I did all the Latino rooms early on. Yeah, that's all I knew. That's why I say.
So, like, I don't know anything about that world. Like, I mean, literally on my show, and to a fault, I mean, I've done 500 episodes. I've had Carlos in here. Mm-hmm. I've had Willie in here.
Is this the room where he bared his soul to you?
Yeah.
Okay.
It took two episodes to do that. I got bullshit.
I heard him.
The first episode.
And then, this is what I really meant to say.
And then he just came unglued a little bit. So I had Barcena in here and Trevino.
Hey, but bro. Like,
Barcena's great, though, right?
That's as real as it gets.
Yeah.
You know exactly where you stand with Willie Barcena. You know?
Was he a
love
guy
him,
when
Love
he's...
him or hate him, that's you get exactly what you get.
Was he a guy when you started?
Actually, that room that was in Montebello was his room. It was his room and Felipe Esparza's. And I would show up there on Wednesdays and Saturdays, and Willie's like, hey, put up the fact, you bro. And I'd go up there, and hey, little Chubbies, Chubbsy Wubbsy. He'd always call me Chubbsy Wubbsy.
Oh, boy.
And I'd go up and do, my 5-7 minutes, just being silly.
But, I don't even know who the guys were. I don't even know who the guys are. And I feel bad about it, because there's a whole world of Latino comedy that I don't know who they are. Who are they?
Back in the day, there was a few. There was a handful. When I first started, there was a handful. Everybody looked up to Willie. Willie Barcena was the guy, just because, you know what? He had been on The Tonight Show. And that was huge. You know, yeah. He had been on Leno's show like 5-6 times.
Yeah.
And, I recognized Felipe Esparza because Felipe had been on the Latino Laugh Festival on Showtime. So I remember those faces. And then that's where I also met Joey Medina. Joey Medina, by the way, probably gave me the greatest advice ever as a comic. When he saw me performing, I was really, really dirty.
Yeah.
And he goes, you know what, bro? He goes, you're likable. He goes, just cut out the cuss words, man, and more windows and doors are going to open for you.
Uh-huh.
And that was the best advice I did. I cut out all the, all the F-bombs and stuff in my show. And next thing I'm working everywhere.
And those are, because now who do you see? Like, I think obviously Lopez was huge.
Mm-hmm.
And
there was always the guys. It was like Paul Rodriguez, Lopez, Mencia, Pablo Francisco.
Oh yeah.
Freddie Soto back in the day.
Freddie, yeah. Yeah, it's because if you really think about the breakdown of what the country is like the Latino population is humongous.
Mm-hmm.
And it's same with black comics too. And me, it's sort of like, I don't know how do I get to those guys. Do I just call, and I know maybe I'm being lazy or what, but it just seems complicated. Like, there's a whole world of comedy out there that I don't fucking know anything about.
Mm.
Like, the Latino circuit, I don't know any of those guys, but there's a circuit, right?
There's definitely a circuit. I mean, like I said, back then it was a handful, so everybody knew who was doing what. There was, guys that I would roll around were like Willie Barcena, Felipe, Joey Medina, Alex Raimundo back then, Gilbert Esquivel, Rudy Moreno always had a room. There was guys like Sebastian Satina who had their own little comedy rooms and stuff like that.
And what was the tone? Was it usually, like neighborhood-oriented family stuff? Or?
That's exactly what it was. It was very local humor. Uh-huh. Yeah. What about the security guard at King Taco? Oh, my God. That guy's got more ammunition than a federale in Mexico.
Really?
I mean, stuff like that. Yeah. It was very, very local.
And there was no, thinky guys or, weird guys where you're like, what's that guy?
There was a couple heady guys, but nobody understood them. Nobody really wanted to deal with them. Oh, really? You're trying to make me think? Talk about the Dodgers, bro. Talk about this.
There's a lot of pressure.
That. Yeah. I mean, and if all you're doing is this little area, then why try to think outside of that?
But also just the fact that, that it was community driven in tone, that the relatable things were family issues, local issues. Mm-hmm. Like, there was a sort of a tone to the culture that people were looking to identify.
And there was a lot of Spanish involved too. So there was my sets, there was a lot of Spanglish.
Uh-huh.
You say a joke and then you just add a little, tú sabes lo que estoy diciendo, verdad? And they're like, he's speaking Spanish. And if there was white people there, it was kind of like the Ricky Ricardo syndrome where we don't know what he's saying, but it's really funny when Ricky snaps.
Yeah.
So
that was part of it. That was part of your act early on.
Yeah. I was doing a lot of Spanish, a lot of voices, characters. Like I said, I was dirty early on until I started changing that up. And then the fluffy thing happened and I just wrote.
But were you always heavy?
Yeah, I really, when I first started, I was,
You were bigger.
No, when I first, when I, well,
but
yeah.
No, but now you look good.
I'm down about 110 pounds.
Holy fuck.
Yeah, I know.
How much did you get up to?
I got up to about 440, 445.
What the fuck?
Yeah. Oh, hey, the road was good. when I first started, I was probably right around the weight that I am right now, which is about 330.
Yeah.
And, being a person who you're struggling every day to try to get make ends meet in the beginning, and then you get into this position where I can eat out every single day.
Yeah.
I'm like, why even cook at home? And don't get me wrong, it wasn't like I was eating at these great restaurants.
Right.
But I was eating fast food and enjoying it every single night for 13, 14 years before my body eventually said, dude, really? Like, that's why when I watched that movie, Supersize Me, and the guy goes on and he's, 30 days, my body's like, oh my God, I can't take it. I'm like, dude, days. Try 12 years, pussy. You know what I mean? You don't know about putting damage on your body.
Yeah, but did it get to a point where the doc was like, dude?
Oh, that's exactly where it got. It got to the point where...
440.
How
would you walk? Was it hard to walk?
You know what? Believe it or not, at 440, I was still pretty limber. I mean, I'm a big dude, but I'm pretty solid underneath, man. Yeah. I can squat about 400.
Oh, really?
In addition to the weight that I got going on. I worked the leg press pretty good, but I had no problems getting around. My knees started taking... I needed surgery on my knees. I messed up my knees really bad. Started getting cortisone shots on a regular basis. And then I'm type 2 diabetic, and my sugar was like 300 plus every morning.
Did you get that, or were you always that?
No. I got that from all the years of
Eating shit.
Eating everything, man.
Yeah.
And then so between all the eating and then the drinking, and then just it just escalated to where it was like, you know what? This is not going to end well if I keep this up. And I'm going somewhere really good, and if I want to enjoy it, I better do something about
it. Right, you don't want to be have that thing. You know, finally get to the top of the world and be like, I need a chair.
Freaking die in the toilet. Yeah, that's just what I need.
Yeah. But okay, so you're doing all the Latino rooms, and when you're starting out, you're 20 years old, and you're getting your chops in place. So when did you cross over?
There was a couple TV shows out back then that really, you know, showcased comics. There was the show on Comedy Central called Premium Blend.
Yeah.
And for Latinos, there was a show on the Galavision Network called Que Locos. Que Locos was a Spanish... the Galavision Network was Spanish-speaking, but the comedy show was in English. And George Lopez was a host, and I got to appear on the show many times.
So it was like the Latino Def Jam?
That's exactly what it was.
Right.
That's exactly what it was. And the network would rerun that show 5 times a day. And they'd also run commercials for a tour. And so I was always on TV.
At what age?
So this, like when, how? 21, 22.
So you're 2 years in.
Yeah.
And you're getting this.
It's getting all this,
traction. Because you're on fire. There's that kid.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's that kid.
And it was always the chubby kid with the Hawaiian shirt who makes noises, real friendly.
But was that a choice you made early on, or just because of that, you're like, I better keep the Hawaiian shirt on?
You know what? I like I said, the whole fluffy thing. The Hawaiian shirt and the shorts. Those three things.
From the beginning. You just knew that.
It was branding. You know, that was one thing I learned.
Yeah, I don't know anything about that. But
Well, when I was working over at Robinson's May, you know, I'd always hang out with these guys from the marketing department. And they're always talking about branding and branding and branding. And anytime there's a product, there's a way that you brand it.
Yeah.
You got to be consistent with it. And if you change it, you got to slightly change it. You can't do too much. Otherwise, you know. You can't go from a Ford Explorer and then all of a sudden you chop it up and now it's a different car. You got to slowly modify it.
Right.
You know, and that's why they said, when I started growing a goatee, I had to introduce this really slow because a lot of fans turned on me for it. They're like, wait, why you growing facial hair?
Really?
You've always been the clean cut. And I go, I'm just trying to go a different look. And they say that if you have facial hair, it thins down your face. I'm just trying to slim down my face.
So you had to do that on stage.
Yeah.
You had to say.
I explained, yeah. And so the same thing with the weight.
Because I think they like when you're a heavyset guy and you got a boyish face, they kind of have this, it's cuter to them. They don't want to think you're an adult man.
Yeah, I'm like, what? Is he growing? Because kids hated it. Adults were like, yeah, you look more grown up.
And more.
But the kids were like, ugh.
Yeah.
And then going from 440 to 330, people are going, wait a minute, you're changing your image. You're not fluffy no more. I'm like, relax, I'm 300 pounds. If I lose another 100 pounds, I'm still going to be 200 something pounds.
People actually said that to you?
Yes, they're more concerned about the image than the
fans. If you lose too much weight, you're not going to be that kid anymore.
You're not going to be fluffy no more. I'm like, are you kidding me?
Oh,
you
know? That's crazy.
Like, this is all I'm going to talk about.
But that really happened. People are like, why are you getting so skinny?
Why are you losing weight? And I'm like, because I'm diabetic, because I want to live. I want to enjoy the check.
So you had to address that on stage too.
Yes, I had to address that.
So you learn from these guys you're working with for Macy's. About branding.
Branding and marketing. And then also, too.
That's really where it happened.
Back in the day, yeah.
And you were able at that point to be, you know, have the foresight. Because I never, you knew you were in show business. And you knew that in order to get the big payoff that, you know, people got to know you.
They got to know you.
And that means you got to stay the way you are. You just, that's something you put together.
Yes. There was, like I said, there was a lot of comics that we'd see that would always change their image. They were inconsistent. You look at them on three different shows, and all three different shows, they had different looks. One time he'd have really long hair. One time short hair. One he's wearing a jersey in one. He's wearing a leather jacket in another. He's wearing just a regular button up in this one. So there was no consistency right there.
You noticed that?
Yes.
Yeah. And you're like, I'm the Hawaiian shirt, shorts, I'm fluffy.
You know, you're gonna change your image. You got to stay consistent.
All right. So right out of the gate, you're doing that. And now you're 2 years in. How much material you got?
2 years in.
20?
Maybe 20, 30 minutes.
But now you got 20 or 30 minutes, and you know you're becoming a known comic in at least the Latino community.
Mm-hmm. Oh, very known in the Latino community. I mean, obviously when I go places like Richmond, Virginia, or
no, but I mean like early on because of the Galavision.
Yeah.
How many of those did you do?
I want to say about 5.
And so that means that you're like on TV every day.
And also the fact that they had me on their tour. Mike Robles, who was the executive producer of the show at the time,
right?
He had put together this comedy tour called the Que Locos Comedy Tour, and he had Willie Barcen on it. He had Carlos Oscar, Gilbert Esquivel, Felipe Esparza, and myself. And so they'd run ads during the day. All, you know, every hour you'd see this commercial that would pop up on
television. And how many millions of people watched that? Millions of people watched that.
Couldn't tell you, but yeah. It was enough to where I'd pull into a Burger King and they'd flip out.
Yeah, fluffy.
Yeah. I was very much, from the get-go, just a worker. I was getting up anywhere and everywhere, and I hit the road early on.
Yeah.
Joey Medina got me my first gig on the road in Bart Reed's comic strip in El Paso, Texas, and I became a regular there, and I was performing there about 4-5 times a year doing, emceeing and stuff like that.
Right.
And then I just picked up more gigs.
Also San Antonio,
that.
Right? Didn't you do River
a lot,
Center?
A lot of work in San Antonio.
So Texas was big.
Texas was very big early on.
Yeah.
I got to play comedy clubs there before I got a chance to touch a Laugh Factory.
Huh. So, okay, so you go on the Loco tour with mm-hmm. these, and how were those crowds?
Oh, they were insane. Oh, obviously, it was 100%, Latino crowd, and so all that stuff that I was doing, speaking in Spanish, making local references to certain things,
uh-huh.
things that only Latinos knew, it was killing.
And so once you started doing the bigger gigs and hosting in Texas, mm-hmm. was it still primarily Latino crowd?
Yes. Yes, I mean, when you ask about when did I finally make that jump and cross over, it had to have happened after the tour went away. And then I just I started trying to do my own shows with a promoter. And, we do California, then we do Arizona, Nevada, Texas.
Right.
And I'm like, when are we going to go start playing, No, this hey, man, this is your
why here. Push it?
And the crazy thing is that I was getting paid very well to do these theaters in the Southwest. And I'm like, you know what? I'm telling my manager, listen, I gotta break out. I gotta be able to play some of these other markets. And so she was like, well, look, you're going to take a serious pay cut. And you're going to go from a theater. You got to go back to a club, and a club that you might not even fill. And I'm like, well, I gotta break the markets. That was one thing early on, too, that I heard from a promoter. He says, you got to break a market. Anytime you break a market, you're going to take a hit. But you got to go in and get people to know you so they'll talk about you. So when you come back, you start building it up.
And did that happen?
Yes, it did. One of the first places we went was West Palm Beach, Florida. And
to the Improv?
Yeah. And keep in
mind, were you doing spots in town yet?
In spots where? In
here
LA?
In L.A., yeah.
Yeah, but it was the Latino night. It was Monday night at the Laugh Factory,
right?
Where Jamie takes off and he lets all the Mexicans in the building. Here you go, buddy. Nobody has point of view. So yeah, that was only getting a couple little spots there, but I had nothing consistent going on in LA. But when we started doing the shows in Florida, I mean, I was lucky to get in a room that sat 350. I was lucky to get 50 people.
How'd that hit your ego?
It did. It did, and I kept thinking, oh, I was like, all right, do I want to do this and kind of just start over?
And were the 50 people that knew you, were they mostly Latino people that knew you?
There were some Latinos in there, and some people that just, they saw the video of the upcoming act. You know how they always
last
play the
week,
video every
yeah.
week?
So when you went, did you start to pull the Spanish out or no?
I did. I messed up, and I didn't know any better. I went over there, and I'm just trying to do the same thing that I was doing everywhere else. And then when you start getting the looks and you realize, you know what, they don't all understand this. That you need to do material that is friendly enough for anyone to enjoy. Because I started running into a situation where I had more white people than Latinos at the show.
And that was new to you.
And that was very new to me.
So did you feel like it must have been a weird feeling, because when you're entrenched in the community, then all of a sudden, you know, you draw this line because in your mind it's like, well, we got our people here. So now you're like, it's almost like I'm behind enemy lines here.
I'm like, I gotta find out how they think.
Yeah, they're just looking at me like I'm some Mexican.
So then I'm sitting there and I'm picking apart my act. I'm like, oh my God, I can't do this joke. I can't do this joke. And I can't do this joke. This is not going to work. And this is not going to work.
Next thing,
I find myself, I find myself doing 12 minutes of crowd work to try to compensate. And, you know, I was always rolling with the same crew, same group of guys that I've been rolling, you know, for the last 15 years.
Comics?
And they had to learn as well.
Like which guys? Like
Martin Moreno.
Yeah.
First time I took him.
Your feature and your opener?
He's my MC. I alternate middle acts all the time. But Martin's been the one that's been there since day one.
And he's the same. He's doing Spanish. And he's
Yeah, both of us. I mean, he's doing jokes about
Walker. So at least you got a friend.
Yeah.
About what?
Walker, Texas Ranger. Remember the...
Yeah.
He'd do jokes about gang members and these cholos, right? And he's talking like that. And, and we're in Richmond, Virginia. And the people are like, I'm sorry.
We don't have that here.
Yeah.
So did you bomb?
I bombed.
Really?
Oh, yeah. I had my sets where I was like, oh, my God. And
horrible.
You know,
They weren't horrible.
Like,
no, it's a horrible feeling.
It is a horrible feeling.
To sort of be like this rock star in the Latino community. Then, like, you're like, standing there in front of 50 white people sweating.
And you're like, ugh.
What'd I do? But you always knew in the back of your head, I could live forever on that circuit.
But I knew eventually, you know, that's going to run out, man. You're gonna burn your markets out. And then what? If you only got, you know, 12 markets that you hit.
Yeah.
And you can only hit them once every 18 months.
Yeah. Well, so how did you start to change?
I started doing more clubs that were not in, you know, Latino.
How did you start to feel what was the disposition? Because now, like, when I watch your stuff now, you have a full identity. You know, you've brought your family into it. You're dealing with, you know, things that everybody can relate to. But at some point, you had to sit down and go, well, what is common? What do we all share that they're going to fucking, you know, understand? Everyone understands family. So if I pull the Spanish out of this and I explain it correctly, they'll understand it.
Absolutely.
Is that what happened?
Yes. Yes. I pulled out the Spanish and I just started talking about things everyone can relate to. Everyone can relate to a situation with a relationship. Everyone can relate to a family event. Everyone can relate to having that crazy friend who, you know, oh man, hey, you know, that one guy at the office or somebody that, stuff like that people can relate to. People can relate to a story of a fish out of water. So telling stories about going to places that I've never been and saying, well, this was my mentality when I went in because this is what I learned. And then as it turns out, this is the way that it is. And so people, you know, they were intrigued by that. It was cool. And it was stuff that everybody can relate to. Everybody can relate to being the new guy somewhere and not knowing what's going on.
And do you think that, you know, because of the way, you know, you kind of make, you know, your disposition, you know, but also your brand, that, you know, you're this, you know, heavyset guy that wears these shorts. Yeah, fluffy, that it was disarming. You're not going to get on stage and people go like, fuck this guy. Like this guy, you know, like you're like, everybody wants to give you a hug, right?
Yeah. It's the greatest feeling. I mean, people still to this day bring me cakes and they bring food to the shows and sodas.
Yeah.
And can we take you to the house? And I'm like, that's for people to want to do that. I mean, that's a whole different level of connection with the people.
How long did it take you to build the act that could play anywhere?
Got to figure by 2005, we were basically going anywhere in the U.S.
So that's
2005, 2006. So I almost 10 years.
Yeah, it took a long time, a lot of work.
Oh.
So, all right, so now, when do you start, like, you know, becoming this? Because now, you know, at some point, you got regular spots at the Improv and regular spots at the Laugh Factory.
I was getting, anytime I wanted to do a Monday night, I had, you know, just make a phone call to show up there. But it wasn't like I could get a whole week at the Laugh Factory. Same thing with the Comedy Store. I'd have to show up at 1 o'clock in the morning to wait for somebody to, you know.
And you were selling out in Texas.
Yeah, but, it didn't translate to stage time here.
Right.
It was like, okay, well, you're on the road. You're a road comic.
Was there a point where you got the respect you wanted here? Like in the world of Hollywood and the comedy?
This was probably about 5 years ago when it finally started happening, where I'd walk into the Comedy Store and they'd say, hey, you want to go up? And I'm like, I don't have time to wait till 1. Like, no, we'll bump the next guy if you want to go up. I'm like, you serious?
Yeah.
Like, yeah.
That's a big day, right?
So that was pretty cool.
Yeah.
And then you got those comics that never leave that building and give you that dirty look.
Yeah, like, who the fuck?
Yeah.
Him?
Like, really?
Him? Where's he been? I've been here every night for 5 years.
Yeah. Hanging out here waiting for, what is the name? William Apervia that would show up.
Oh, no.
Only comics know who he is.
Yeah. Did you have a crew here? Did you hang out with Carlos or those guys?
I'd run into Carlos every blue moon when there'd be some major event.
Because, despite whatever, his horrible legacy is in terms of the community, like, he was a real businessman too. I mean, like, when I talked to him, it was like,
very,
holy fuck,
very
dude.
Business. We have the same agent, and anytime I'd hear about Mencia on the road, it was very much, it was a business. He'd do his thing.
The recordings. That was fucking genius.
Stuff like that.
Actually, he'd have them available by the end of the night.
Yeah, recording CDs from that same show. Home the same CD that you just heard. Take home the same show you just heard.
When he finally figured out how to put it on a flash drive, that changed everything because he could do it in a second. Like, I never had that kind of thinking. But do you do merch?
My merch is very, very impressive. I took a huge page out of the WWE handbook.
Uh-huh.
I study wrestling because wrestling is probably the biggest form of entertainment out there, with just the level of production, the level of intensity, and the marketing and the merchandise.
CM Punk sat there.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Sweet. I'm freaking geeking. I'm a huge CM Punk fan.
Yeah, I'm not a wrestling guy, but he was a fan of my show, and his buddy Colt Cabana does a podcast kind of like this show, and he was a fan of my show. So I interviewed Colt in Chicago, and then Colt set me up with Punk, and he came in.
Oh, sweet.
So I had to be schooled, but it was interesting to talk to him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I want him to come back really bad.
I
think he's eventually going to come back.
What else is he going to do?
He's showing up at Blackhawk games that aren't,
Oh, he's just living the life? He's like, fuck it. He's really building it. This is a hell of a fucking script.
Yeah, if it's an angle, then they got us all.
It's a long one, man.
They got us all.
So, okay, so you put all this, you've had a childhood love of wrestling your whole life?
Oh, yeah. I've been watching wrestling since 85. Hulk Hogan and Andre the Giant, that was it right there. I was hooked after that.
And, knowing full well, like, the people that love wrestling, they know exactly what it is, and they still
exactly
love it.
What it is. I watch it for what it is. It's a nice glorified male soap opera, and it's entertainment. Yeah. I watch it for that.
So what did you pull from how'd you design your
big
merch
show,
around
man.
That?
Well, first of all, the show. Yeah. My show now, I got, screens, and I got all kinds of stuff all over the stage, gobo lights. It's a rock show. It really is.
I saw that in some of the clips from the new movie.
Mm-hmm. We bring a nice production to the show, and the video screens and the merchandise is huge. I mean, we've got a whole truck dedicated to just merchandise.
What do you sell?
You name it. I mean, I've got like 15 different t-shirts. There's hats, bumper stickers, three different types of bobbleheads, action figures, cups, beanies, lanyards. We sell cardboard cutouts.
And it all sells.
Everything sells. Everything sells. And I've even got stores in the malls too. Yeah.
Huh? You do?
Yeah, a little kiosk that I set up. It's, it's the fluffy shop.
Well, you just pay them all for the permit?
The little kiosk. They get the little carts and stuff. You see in the malls.
When you go to a town, you mean?
I have one set up at Lakewood Mall. Uh-huh. I had a couple that were scattered around town, but I usually wait till the holidays to bring out more carts.
Huh. So that's a big part of your business.
Yes, merchandising.
You love it.
Yeah. It works. Yeah. It's a huge part of the business.
And that started to pick up when you got bigger
when
and
started,
bigger.
When I started doing the big tours. In 2010 is when the first we got sponsorship through, what was a cell phone company? It was a new cell phone company at the time, and Comedy Central.
Yeah.
And so they put this whole Fluffy Shop tour together, and they let me call it the Fluffy Shop Tour. It was like, I wanted to name my merchandise company.
Yeah.
So that was the name of the tour, was the merchandise company, Fluffy Shop Tour.
Uh-huh.
And we went everywhere, and they were running ads for it, and the merch just started picking up and picking up.
When was the year where you saw the crowd changing, where you were successfully playing to everybody? What is the percentage now?
It was definitely past 2005.
Yeah.
And right now, I think it's right. It's pretty even.
Really?
It's pretty even.
That's amazing, man.
Certain cities, it's a little bit more, like San Antonio.
Sure.
It'll go from 50-50 to like maybe 70-30.
Yeah. And now you've toured the world,
mm-hmm.
and you got this movie, which is a concert movie.
Concert movie.
Which people, like, only a few people do those.
So I'm in pretty good company.
Yeah, you pretty are. Good company. With Pryor and, Eddie Murphy, and some people have done movies, but, like, a lot of people just do a special, but this is going to be in theaters.
Mm-hmm.
And it's called, what is it, Fluffy the Movie?
The Fluffy Movie.
The Fluffy Movie.
Yeah, everything I've ever done always incorporates the word.
And what's the angle?
Well, the first 7 minutes is a mini film about the night that my mom and dad met. and how I came to be about.
A comedy film?
A comedy film, yeah.
Sure.
And right after that, the concert starts. It leads into the concert, and it's about, I want to say, 97 minutes.
Only shot in one place?
We shot it in San Jose. Yeah, well, anytime you bounce around and you start showing multiple locations,
it's weird.
It gets a little too weird.
You know, to me, when I watched Chris Rock do that, I was like, wow, this is amazing. It's showing that he's doing the exact same joke, the exact same way in 50 cities.
It's, yeah.
It almost destroys the illusion of what we do. It's like that exact same joke in a different clothing. Yeah, it was, to me, it was like, why would you do that? It's almost, it undermines the mystery of what we do. Because
telegraphed it. It's going to be the same here. It's going to be the same there.
Right. And not unlike wrestling, I think people want to believe like he's just making it up. You know what I mean? Like it's happening now.
Mm-hmm.
So if you show, you know, if you play your hand like that, holy shit, this guy didn't change nothing.
It's
no matter
exactly
where
the same.
He goes. Yeah, it's crazy. I thought that was a crazy misfire.
Yeah, he should have just kept it in one.
Why not?
He should have just kept it. And it got me dizzy bouncing back and forth with it.
Yeah, but you did tour like all over the world, right?
Yes.
And how did that go for you?
The first time I played Canada, I was really nervous just because it was that same feeling of when I first went to Florida. You know, I was like, oh, are they going to get it? Are they going to understand it? So I'm second guessing everything.
Are there Mexicans in Canada?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
But at the time when I went to Canada, I had already gotten past that, you know.
Yeah, sure.
That, that Latino thing. Let me just try to relate to whoever I'm there with. And it was just for laughs. It was Montreal.
Sure.
And I'm like, oh, great.
Yeah.
Here they speak French. So
yeah.
Now I'm like, okay, what's going to happen?
But they got it, right?
Oh, that's such a hip crowd.
Yeah.
And,
well, but also, that it's like family, man.
It's next door.
Yeah. They know what's up.
It's next door. And when you go to other parts of the world, you realize just how close Canada is and how it's just the same. It's the exact same thing.
Where did you go to London?
I got to perform in London. London.
How was that?
Manchester.
That's not an easy crowd.
No, but you know, when I got there, I already had the fan base and you know, the YouTube stuff. So when I got there, the fans were solid. They were here to see Fluffy. It wasn't like who are we gonna come to say it and all. Nothing. They were excited. They're chanting Fluffy. They're already wearing the T-shirts before I even walk out on stage.
So you have a YouTube channel?
Yeah, I have a YouTube channel.
And you do what? How do you treat that? What do you do?
My YouTube channel, I basically update content, stand-up content. I don't try to do anything that's real...
But you don't want to tip all your bits, so you're selective, or how does it work?
Well, I put stuff that's already out.
Oh, okay.
You know, anything that's new doesn't come out until it's already been put either in on cable or
right.
been put on somewhere else.
Right, okay.
Or if I do a late-night talk show or something, I'll put, you know, snippets and
sure,
bits
sure.
like that.
Sure, right, right. Oh, that's good. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so I mean...
And that gives you global exposure.
Yeah, I mean, if it only plays in the U.S., it's not going to do me any good when I go, you know, anywhere else. So I want to make sure that everybody can see it.
Have you had to sweat one out recently?
What do you mean?
A show? When you've gone somewhere? Have you had any tricky ones? Where you're like, yeah, it's not, you know, had to sort of like, all right, well, I guess they're not getting it completely.
Not recently. It's been very, very good, very, very consistent the last year or so. But I've had a couple corporate gigs that didn't go exactly the way I wanted them to. I did a show for, they were raising money for battered women.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was this function that they did in Florida. And the floor, it was at the Hard Rock, and the floor was all people for this benefit. And the balcony, they opened it up to my fans to buy tickets. So when I walk out on stage, I'm getting roars from the balcony, but the floor is just very polite and very, you know, round tables and
the people that paid the big money.
People that paid the big money right. for this fundraiser.
Just there because they have to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I had to follow a lady that went up there and told this 15-minute-long horrific story about how she survived domestic violence. And then they played a video after that. And then, here's Gabriel Iglesias to make you laugh. And I'm like, are you freaking kidding me? I gotta follow this.
Classic story.
You know?
And, yeah.
Oh, man, it was brutal.
And you couldn't make light of it.
No. No, you couldn't. There's nothing you could say. I mean, you just got to go out there and go, hey, you guys, we're here for a great cause. And, you know, you got to really kiss up and do as much positive crowd work
right.
and way to survive. And, hey, you guys, this is a night for, you know, to build up the.
You can't go up and go like, I don't think she's going to laugh. I don't think that's going to happen.
Yeah. You can't go up there and start cracking jokes like that. But it was crazy because as soon as I walked out, the balcony's going crazy.
Yeah.
They want me to do a regular show.
Yeah.
And then the floor, they made it clear. You can't talk about certain things during your show. And I'm like. It was very frustrating
because
I'm killing upstairs, but I'm getting nothing downstairs.
That's the nature of that kind of gig.
And then people are ignoring me. And my problem is I look at all the people
sure.
and it started bugging me. People started turning their backs to me so they could eat, so they could do everything else.
Worst.
And I'm like, really?
Yeah.
And then I just snapped at one point. I snapped and I'm like, hey, you guys, I'm trying to, you know, do this for you. We want to make this happen. I says, at least show me a little bit of respect, to just at least look at me. If you're not going to laugh, at least look at me.
Yeah.
And you could feel the people on the side of the stage like, get him off, get him off. He's going rogue. And I just started cussing up a storm. I'm like, yeah, this is bullshit. I don't need to do this. I said, you know what, you guys? And to the people upstairs, I apologize. I go, I want to give you guys a great show. I go, but this is not going the way it's supposed to go.
And you snapped, man.
I snapped. And then I says, you know what, you guys? I says, you guys offered me a lot of money to play this show tonight. And this is what I want to do. I want to finish my set, but I want you guys to keep all of it and apply it to your cause, because I think that's the most important thing tonight. And I said that, and then the whole floor stands, gives me a standing ovation. And I'm like, no, you don't understand. I'm still going to do 5 more minutes. Sit down so I can finish
I'm doing
performing.
This because I'm bombing.
Yeah, basically.
Yeah, dude.
Basically. And I learned that from Jay Leno. We did a gig together at the Laugh Factory for a group that's kind of like PETA.
Uh-huh.
And Jay went up there and started doing jokes about his cats. And they did not feel him. And at the end of his set, he goes, you know, I'd like to donate $10,000 to your cause. And then everybody stood up, and I'm like, oh my God, he just straight pulled that
good
little
closer.
Closer. Freaking took in the butt, and now here you go.
Here you go. I just fucking did it.
I went into the Jay Leno vault right then and
that's
there.
Great.
And I pulled that one out. But I mean, I try not to do those corporate gigs because, you know, they don't make it fun for you. They put too many rules on you and then putting you in a situation where you got to fight.
Yeah, if you believe in the cause, just give them money. And yeah, it makes it difficult. Yeah. So what do you perform for the troops?
I've done a couple of USO tours. I did the USO. I did the Air Force Reserve.
Right.
Those are great, and they appreciate the hell out of it. When you show up there, they're like, "Wow, you brought a piece of home here."
Yeah.
And
that must feel great.
They fly us out there on these massive C-17s, and they land in these combat zones, and you're just like, "Oh my God!"
Yeah.
Freaking out.
Yeah, but they all went well.
Yeah, they all went really good.
So where are you going now? What's the plan? The movie opens?
The movie opens July 11th.
Well, you can do Howard. What do you do?
They're talking about Howard.
Yeah?
I'm a little nervous, man, because Howard has he's got a good talent for finding stuff.
I did it for the first time last year when my show came on. I'd never done it. I was nervous.
Yeah,
but like sometimes it's not, you know, as depending on what kind of comic you are, you know, like, what's he going to find? He's not the National Security Administration.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know, like, I bet you with Howard, in like, between me and you, I bet you, you know, he says, so your mom fucked a guitar player. That's why you're here. Something like that. You know what I mean? It's not, you know, it's not going to be, right? It's not going to, I mean, what's he going to get? Like, I was like, he's going to find something. And I get on there. He's like, so you're a jealous, bitter guy. I'm like, yeah, I can talk about that. That's it? That's all you got? No problem. It's probably not going to be that bad.
That's funny. Well, because, you know, it's just that whole, it's the mystique. It's Howard.
Yeah. But, I was completely consumed with, like, what if he finds out that one thing? There's a couple people that know that thing. He'll probably talk
what
to
What if
him.
He's the one that knows that
yeah,
thing?
Yeah, well, if someone gave him that information, then that's going to be bad. But I think he's a pretty great guy. You know, he's not there to make controversy out of you. He likes comics. So
we'll see what happens.
So you're not going to be doing any shows?
I got a couple shows that I'm doing this month. I'm going to be in Texas.
Yeah.
Back to Texas. I'm playing San Antonio and Houston. San Antonio, Houston, and Laredo.
Uh-huh. Now are you going to have your dad up for the premiere?
I thought about it. I really thought about it, especially the fact that I have somebody in the movie playing him. Haven't reached out to him yet, but I think I have to. I think I own that.
Yeah.
So I think I'm gonna you know, invite him, fly him out.
It's like it's a complete sort of like, not only is it, you know, respectful and shows some sort of sign of closure, but it's victorious. I mean, you know,
it's a feel good story. And this special is different than anything that I've done because I get very, very personal with it and really tell some stories about my past and just my, you know, growing up and some of the stuff that I've been doing lately, dealing with the diabetes and the reason why I had to lose weight and, you know, my family situation.
Uh-huh.
So it's different than what I've done.
And you have kids?
I have a son.
Now, has he met your dad?
Yes, he did. He met him, but you know what? He's, you know, he's a teenager, and he had his iPod on, and he's like, "Hey, what's up?" That's what he meant.
You got a teenager?
Yeah. Well, really? He's technically my stepson, but I mean, I've had him for 11 years now. So.
Uh huh. And does he like what you do?
He loves what I do. I don't think he wants to get into it, but he definitely loves it. Anytime I, hey, you want to go on the tour bus? You want to come out on the road? Yeah, I'm there.
Good.
Now, does he watch my show? Not really. Does he hang out with the guys? Of course.
Right. All right, man. Well, it's great talking to you. I'm glad we finally did this.
Finally. Thank you.
Yeah, man. That's it. That's our show, folks. I enjoyed that. He's a very sweet guy, man. And he's a big act. And I don't mean that derogatorily. He's large, but he's not as large as he used to be, which we discussed, but he's very popular. And I want to thank him for coming. And what else do I want to do? Go to WTFpod.com. Get the app. Get the free app. Upload to the premium, and you can stream every episode of this show. It's quite an archive there. I'm proud of it. Enjoy. Okay? Enjoy it. What else have I got to tell you? Oh, yeah. You can go... what else can you do at WTFpod.com? Get some Just Coffee. You can check out the merch. There's T-shirts. There's things there. You can kick in some money for the patent troll issue, which I think I'll talk at length about another time, maybe on Thursday. You can leave a comment. Yeah, whatever. Okay, all right. Now I'm kind of buzzed out. Boomer lives! Yeah.